You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the American League West. I'm Richard Justice of MLB.com. We'll be checking in on the American League West today, a division where the expectations are high, where some of the moving and shaking in baseball has already begun, and there's plenty more to come. I'm joined by Alvin Gonzalez, who covers the Angels for MLB.com. And Alvin, while lots of moving and shaking going on around baseball, the Angels have been quiet. Do you think this reflects the fact that this team won more games than any team in baseball last year? And as you look at them going forward, this is a club with very few needs.
Yeah, definitely, Richard. They got I think it's basically two reasons. One is obviously the fact that they won 98 games, and when you're a team that wins 98 games and has mostly everybody coming back, then you're really not going to be in a position where you kind of need to do much besides tinkering the roster. And I think the other reason, too, is kind of, I don't want to say their stance, that may be a little too firm, but the luxury tax threshold has kind of been their spending limit these last few years. They haven't provided any indication that they're willing to go over that luxury tax threshold. And they're about less than $10 million below that $189 million mark. So every indication that I've gotten this offseason has been that they're not really in on any of the big free agents. They're not really even in on any of the middle-tier free agents. Frankly, I wouldn't be all that surprised if they went through this entire offseason without signing somebody to anything more than the major league minimum. Now, having said that, Artie Moreno is a very competitive guy, and sometimes he does things that really surprise us, like two off-seasons ago when he went out and signed Josh Hamilton to a $125 million contract. So that's why I wouldn't completely rule anything like that out, but all indications from the start of the playoffs to the end of the playoffs up until now is that they're not really going to be a major player in the free agent market.
Well, Alden, if we were going to play the hypotheticals, and that's what we do in the offseason, what would they need? I mean, would it be just as simple as adding a starting pitcher? Is there a pressing need for a team that won 98 games?
Well, if there was a move to be made here, and if they were going to make the big splash, and if they were going to say that, forget about the luxury tax threshold, we're going to blow past it, we have all this revenue coming from TV, we draw 3 million fans a game, blah, blah, blah. If they're going to blow past it, then it would be to add a starting pitcher. Again, I don't see that happening, but if it were to happen, it would be to go out and get a Max Scherzer, a John Lester, maybe to a lesser degree, a James Shields, because you put that guy on the top of your rotation, now all of a sudden, Jared Weaver doesn't have to be that ace guy. Obviously, he's getting a little older. His stuff continues to diminish a little bit. You're not putting that pressure on Garrett Richards to anchor a rotation coming off some very serious knee surgery that's pretty unprecedented for a starting pitcher. And all of a sudden, you look like one of the best teams in baseball on paper. Now, the problem with that is you're going to commit to another long-term contract when you already have big contracts for Mike Trout and Albert Pujols and Josh Hamilton. And then for the following offseason, you're close to the luxury tax threshold again, and when you surpass the luxury tax threshold a second time, that's a 30% tax on the overage, and that's even greater. And I think that's the biggest reason, too, why they don't want to surpass the threshold, because they know that even if they don't add anybody this offseason, they're going to be close to that mark again next year. And that's a scary thought, because once you get into that position when you're a second, third-time offender to the CB, to the luxury tax threshold, that's when you're really getting taxed very heavily. We saw it with the Yankees. We're seeing it now with the Dodgers. No team wants to be in that situation.
Alan, do you think that organizationally they have confidence that Josh Hamilton still can be a dominant player?
I think they see it just the way everybody else sees it, which is they have no idea what to expect at this point. They want to believe. They have no choice but to believe because they signed him for 3 more years and he's got a full no-trade clause, and because he's pretty much untradeable right now because there's really no value on him. But I think, like everybody else, they have no idea. What they do know is that the talent is there and that he's relatively healthy. I know he battled through shoulder issues and an issue around his rib cage area in the final month of the season, but he didn't require any off-season surgeries, any type of procedures. The only thing he needed was a little bit of rest to kind of let his body recuperate. He's healthy. He's got a bunch of talent, but you don't know. I mean, he's one of the most enigmatic players that I've ever covered, and, you know, he's shown a lot of promise. And I keep going back to this, and I know it was such a short sample size, but those first 2 weeks of the regular season, he looked like Josh Hamilton in his MVP season. He broke his thumb. He never really regained his power, and then the last month of September, he was just fighting uphill because he was never healthy. I don't think they have any idea what to expect from Josh Hamilton next season. I don't think anybody does.
We haven't spoken since Mike Trout won the American League Most Valuable Player Award, probably the award he should have now won 3 times in a row, but that's beside the point. In this season, what did you learn about Mike Trout that maybe you – was there things that surprised you, or just what did you see out of Mike Trout this year that advanced what we know about the kid?
Well, I think just – I mean, Richard, he's an incredible talent. I've said it a million times, everybody has, and he's just got such an uncanny ability to make adjustments in-game and to just never really feel the brunt of the pressure of who he is and all the attention that he gets and things like that. But I thought this was a very interesting season for Mike Trout because many people will say, and I tend to agree that, and this is a compliment to the kid, it really is, this was his worst season. You know, this was his worst season, and there was no doubt that he was going to be the MVP this year. He was a unanimous pick for the award, and, you know, and this was a season that kind of started to show some flaws in his game that actually he needs to shore up and that I think he will shore up. I don't think Mike Trout's ever going to be the kind of player like Albert Pujols who's striking out only 7 times. But I also don't think that he's a guy that strikes out 184 times in a season. I really think that this year, that strikeout total, which was the highest total ever for an MVP winner, I really think that's going to come down. And I can never talk about Mike Trout strikeouts without feeling a little ashamed because it just always sounds like you're being way too nitpicky for a guy who's only 23 years old and who's the best player in baseball. But you think about that, though. He's got such great strike zone awareness. He's so comfortable hitting with 2 strikes, and he's got this really short, compact swing that doesn't really require much maintenance. He's a guy who should not be striking out that much, and a lot of the Angels coaches feel like next year, without the need for major adjustments, he's going to be a lot more efficient at the plate. And he's just still learning himself, Richard. This is a guy who would still be in AA, AAA next year if he was on a normal clock. You know, I expect him to maybe be a little bit more aggressive early in counts, to not fall victim to that elevated fastball, to that rising fastball like he did so much last year. And these are adjustments that he could make very easily by just learning himself, learning his game. And I mean, there are areas for him to improve. And it's just amazing to say that, Richard, for a guy who was just voted the unanimous MVP at age 23.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to you to see the progression of his career and just how high he rises on the greatness charts. And it's a pretty special year for him and for the Angels. And appreciate you joining us, Alvin. We'll see you. Talk to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks, as always. Great work.
Great. Thank you, Richard. Appreciate it, man.
Joined by Jane Lee, who covers the A's for MLB.com. Jane, the A's made their first significant move of the offseason, signing Billy Butler to a 3-year, $30 million contract. And, you know, Jane, when I looked at that deal, I thought maybe 3 years was too long. I think you have to set the money aside because the economics are changing so quickly. The A's really needed right-handed hitting help. And they were not very good at DH last year, and they were not very good at scoring runs down the stretch. How did you look at the Billy Butler signing? Did it catch you by surprise on any level?
A little bit, just because I think you look at Billy Butler and then you look at the A's, it might seem like an odd fit just because, you know, Butler is a full-time designated hitter. I mean, that's just who he is, and the A's don't really employ those types. You know, they love their platoons. They love kind of mixing and matching, especially with the DH. So you look at that and you think, well, you know, are they really going to have him DH every day? Or, you know, are they really going to trust him to play first base sometimes? But more than anything, they needed a right-handed bat. And, you know, you look at what's out there. Of course, there's going to be those top names like Nelson Cruz, the ones that seems like the A's can't afford. And so, you know, the further they were going to get into the off season, you know, once those top names come off the board, then you get into the Billy Butlers, and their price tag goes up just because of the demand. And the A's just didn't want to wait for it to get to that point, because they would have they would not have been able to afford him if they had waited much longer. So they were on his tail from the second they were allowed to contact him. Butler said that Billy Beane was the first to contact him. And, you know, he gave the Royals every opportunity for them to kind of match their offer, but the Royals couldn't even come close. And so, you know, you look at the years, and, yeah, it's a long time, but you kind of knew that that's what he was looking for. You know, you come into free agency for the first time in your career, and there was no other answer for the A's, you know, short-term or long-term, for that needed right-handed bat in the middle of the lineup, and it really just kind of shores up their offense. You know, they're able to go left, right, left in that lineup with guys like Donaldson and Butler and Moss and Reddick. So it really extends their lineup automatically. And it goes without saying, we saw it down the second half, but their offense really needed this. So it was about that more than anything.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it's a kind of a sign. I guess the word is nimble in that, like you said, Billy prefers guys that can move around and they can use a left-handed lineup and a right-handed lineup. But they had a real need, and while teams are sort of getting away from DHs, full-time DHs, this was the best they could do. And they say, okay, he makes us better, and we're not sure anybody else out there we can afford makes us better. I guess in some ways, it's like this is who the A's are. They consider their options by the day, and they are aggressive. I mean, obviously, like you said, he made up his mind. Billy was a guy that they wanted to – that they targeted from day one. I wanted to ask you also about a guy named Alex Hassan. Have I got his name right? Is that his – that they claimed off
you
waivers?
You did, and you know what? He was just claimed off waivers by the Orioles. So he was with the A's organization for all of 3 days.
Yeah, and so I wondered, did they get him with the idea that he had a role as a right-handed hitter? And then when they got Butler, said, okay, let's got Butler. Let's go the other way. It'll be interesting to see if maybe there was value there in Alex Hassan.
Yeah, and you know, you look at his time with the Red Sox, he never really got that extended opportunity that a lot of people felt he deserved. And so then he comes to an A's organization, and you know, they're all about, you know, giving guys opportunities. I think Brandon Moss is kind of the poster boy for that. You know, this journeyman who, you know, just couldn't figure it out, and then the A's gave him that extended opportunity. And I saw Hassan as, you know, this guy who could maybe be that next Brandon Moss, maybe not, you know, to the full capacity that we see of the power that Moss has, but just getting that opportunity, especially in an outfield where there's so many moving parts. But then, you know, you're right in saying, well, you have a guy like Butler, such a strong presence, with a strong right-handed bat, to where those other guys, you know, do become expendable. And I think that's kind of what we saw, especially, you know, during a time where they have to set their 40-man roster, and there just wasn't room for him.
And so Billy Butler is, he's going to wear number 16, and I read this right, that Josh Reddick is going to give it to him or sell it to him. Is he going to give Josh a razor? Do you know what the swap is going to be?
I think a razor would be a good idea, but they're gonna get to know each other, talk a little bit, and I think Butler's going to find out what Reddick, you know, likes and all, and figure out a good gift to give him. It seems like Reddick wasn't really attached to the number 16. It's just kind of, you know, what he ended up with. So I don't think he was too heartbroken to let it go. And, you know, you look at the deal that Butler signed, you're thinking, okay, well, you know, maybe he can afford to give me something nice in return.
Okay. Now, is getting a veteran shortstop still important to Billy, or do you think he's got one of these under-the-radar moves coming? What would you guess they would do at shortstop?
That's, you know, it's such a fluid situation. I think they're kind of, you know, trying to wait and see what happens with the market. You know, there's so many teams in need of a shortstop, or just you know, a middle infielder in general. And so many of those teams are, you know, a lot of the big market teams like the Yankees. And there's so few free agents on the board, you know, including Jed Lowry. And then there's like Astrobel Cabrera and Stephen Drew. And I think of those three, Stephen Drew would probably be the only one in the A's price range. But even still, I mean, you know, he's looking to kind of up his value again. So he might take a one-year deal, which would be great for the A's, because that's kind of all they need is someone to just kind of fill that gap, you know, before some of their young guys, mostly, namely Daniel Robertson, is available and ready for the big leagues. But I don't know that the free agent market is the way to go for them, just because they're not willing to, you know, use the resources that are going to be needed to reel in one of those guys. So I do see a trade being more likely, but not for, you know, an Alexi Ramirez type. He's going to cost them too much. So it might just be for a utility type, you know, like a Cliff Pennington, who is with the A's organization, drafted by them for a long time. The Diamondbacks do have a lot of young shortstops available. The Cubs have a lot of shortstops available. So I think they're going to be, you know, kind of trading from within a pool of these maybe utility types, or, you know, you never know. They could pull someone out of the international market, one of the, you know, young Cuban shortstops or middle infielder that's available. And if none of those come through, they do have Andy Perino in their system. They're very happy with his defense. He hasn't proven much offensively at the big league level, and I really don't see them going into the season with him as their everyday shortstop, but they do have him at least, you know, as an option. But I think this is an area they're just going to explore all possibilities. And I don't see anything happening real soon just because of that, and just because, you know, they might have to wait and see, you know, how the market is for these guys.
Yeah, and the beauty of the A's is they could surprise us. You know, Stephen Drew is an interesting one to me, like if he wanted to reprove himself. And his body of work says, you know, he can still be a productive player. Maybe that would be a marriage, but, you know, and the great thing about the A's is, you know, they could surprise us. They could do anything. That's part of the fun, I'm sure, of covering them, or part of the angst of covering them, because you never know what's next. what would you think would be next on Billy's shopping list? Or if he didn't do anything else, having gotten Butler, do you think they're good enough to go play baseball right now?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they're as deep as they were this year or they were the year before. I mean, their depth is really what's carried them through these past couple of years. And you take a look at the roster right now, and they're just kind of missing that. So I kind of foresee them filling in that depth, maybe strengthening, you know, their bullpen again, which is losing a key guy in Luke Gregerson. You mentioned earlier just the money that's floating around the market these days. I mean, he's going to get top dollars after the year he had, and definitely has outpriced himself from the A's. But, I think just, you know, little pieces here and there, pieces that, you know, you might not, you know, look too closely at or, you know, take a second thought at, but down the road, pieces that are just going to kind of fill in nicely, you know, with their platoon type of system. I do see them adding to their bullpen, maybe an outfielder, but beyond that, I mean, shortstop is their priority, and I think once they, you know, kind of reel that in, they can address other areas. But, you know, they're not really shopping for much else, and they're also not, you know, shopping potential trade bait. They do have Jeff Smarja and Scott Kazmir. I would not be surprised at all if one of them is traded. But, you know, I do want to make it clear they are not shopping, and they're willing to listen on those guys just because they know that they could net them, you know, a few good prospects, and their system's really lacking right now. It's pretty depleted, especially after Addison Russell and Billy McKinney left in the Smarja deal. So if, you know, one team steps forward, a team that isn't willing to spend on a John Lester or a Max Scherzer, but is willing to maybe let go of a few prospects, I do think the A's will listen or hang on to them, and maybe their value is even greater at the trade deadline, at which point they could also get a few prospects. So that's one area I think will really be interesting to watch. Billy Beane said yesterday, specifically talking about Samardzija, he was asked about Samardzija just because his name's been floated around so much that, it's very fluid with him. And so he didn't, he said right now we're very happy to have Jeff at the top of our rotation. But, that's not to say that in a month or a week or in a day, that could change just because of his value and what they can maybe get in return for him.
Yeah, every day is a new day. That's great. That's part of the fun of covering. Anyway, Jane, thank you for your time, and we'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
All right, sounds good. Thank you.
Joined by Greg Johns, who covers the Mariners for MLB.com. Greg, first of all, I wanted to ask you about something that happened at the owners' meeting yesterday in Kansas City. Commissioner Selig gave the team you cover the Commissioner's Award for Philanthropic Excellence, and he was quite articulate in all the work the Mariners do to be a good citizen of the community. Can you just talk briefly about what you know about how important it is and all the things the Mariners do to be part of the community of Seattle?
Sure. I mean, I think it's been an issue near and dear to the hearts of the ownership of the Mariners. The guys that run that organization are good people and good. When they kept the Mariners in Seattle, it was a group of Seattle people that really stepped up and helped make that happen. And those guys, they are involved in the community. And the Commissioner's Award yesterday was was really highlighted around their Refuse to Abuse campaign, a domestic violence campaign to really stress respect at home, and that's an issue that's big in professional sports right now, obviously, and we've seen it in the NFL quite a bit, and it's an issue that they brought up with the Mariners to have an excellent campaign, and they used Felix Hernandez, Lloyd McClendon, Michael Saunders were all very involved in it this past year, and really just driving home the message of respect your family, respect women, respect your kids, don't take it home. When you play hard, respect your opponent on the field. It's just it's more important at home, and that's a great issue, and it's certainly a cool honor for them. First time they'd won that commissioner's award for philanthropic excellence, and well deserved. I think it's certainly a everybody wants teams to win. It's obviously the focus is on getting the best players, the best everything, and certainly the Mariners are trying to do that, but. Same time, they know the importance of being good citizens, and I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was very touching to be there, and obviously the commissioner was he was touched by it. On the field, the Mariners have been associated with every guy who could swing a bat right-handed, from Justin Upton to Billy Butler to right down the line. Do you think Jack Sorensic is trying to make a big splash? Let's say a Justin Upton, who would probably call some Taiwan Walker or somebody of that ilk. Or do you think he would prefer a Torii Hunter? Maybe he could get on a shorter-term contract. What do you think Jack's thinking? Or do you think he's just checking down the list of every option he can?
Well, I think they definitely are checking every option. I mean, he'd like to make the big push. He'd like to get that big bat. They got Cano last year. It doesn't get any bigger than that a year ago. Mm-hmm. Whether you can pull that off 2 years in a row, they made a big push, I know, for Victor Martinez, and I think in the end, Victor probably was not that interested in leaving Detroit if he could get the deal he wanted, and he did. But I know the Mariners were hard after him. They made a big push, and that was not going to be a cheap sign if they could pull it off. They've even kicked the tires pretty hard on Russell Martin, which surprised people as a catcher, given they have a young guy there in Zunino. But Jack is looking at every option, and they need a big bat, a big right-handed hitter or two to help out that lineup. I think they'd love to get one big one and another secondary piece if they could, but whether they can pull that off, maybe they settle for two guys more in the middle tier types if they can do it, but definitely they're pushing for it, and there's still some big names out there. It's an interesting market. Most of the free agents that have gone so far have been hitters. Victor Martinez, Russell Martin, Billy Butler signed with the A's, Kadir, a guy that went real early that certainly would have been of interest to the Mariners. Those are the guys coming off the board right now. So it's interesting. There's still some good names out there. You know, Hanley Ramirez, Nelson Cruz, Melky Cabrera. Yasmani Tomas, the Cuban kid, I think is definitely of interest to a lot of teams. So those are the top names that are still out there, and certainly the Mariners, I think, are being mentioned with every one of them. Certainly looking at every one of them. What comes to pass, we'll have to wait and see. But that's certainly part of the hot stove right now.
Yeah, and my, how times have changed. A year ago, the Mariners were just trying to put something together and get to a certain point, and now we're looking at them like, hey, if they get a right-handed bat, maybe a 1A and a 1B, they're probably as good as anybody in their division. A couple of pitching moves they made this week. They got a left-hander, Almost. Am I saying his name right? Almost?
Edgar Almost.
Yeah, and they got him on waivers. And then a righty, Sam Gaviglio, from they traded the young guy, Ty Kelly, for him. Are these organizational moves, Greg, as you see them, for depth, for insurance? Or do you think Jack Cerenjic makes these deals seeing a role for these guys immediately in the bullpen?
Yeah, I think right now those are organizational depth moves, which are really important for a team. I think we focus all on the big names and things, but teams have to. You've got to have depth through your organization, and I think they look at things right now, and they've got certainly the top tier young guys, but you've got to have guys behind them as well. You got to fill out your Triple A and Double A rosters with quality guys and guys that can come up and challenge when you need them and just make you competitive at that minor league level. And I think they traded Ty Kelly, who was a guy a lot of people were interested in, a 26-year-old infielder, and just didn't really have a spot. I mean, he's a second base, third base guy, and they got Cano and Seager at those spots. And they just, Kelly didn't look like it had a fit and was going to be eligible for the Rule 5 draft. So, they moved him for a pitcher with the Cardinals they maybe can have a spot there in Triple A and be ready to come up if needed. That's the kind of thing you got to do as an organization. You got to look forward, and they certainly do that. Edgar Olmos, left-handed reliever from the Marlins, lefty relievers. You like to have some guys there, and certainly adds to the depth they've gotten in that position. So yeah, I think those are organizational depth moves, and the things you got to do as a club, and smart to do so.
Greg, do you think, other than the two bats that Jack would like to get, is there anything else on his shopping list that is really important for the winter?
He's talked pretty specifically about adding another veteran starter, which is interesting because they have pretty good depth in that rotation with Felix and Iwakuma, obviously, at the top, and James Paxton, Taiwan Walker, and Reyes Elias, three young guys that pitched that all pitched well last year when they were healthy, and Erasmo Ramirez, who's a guy with some time and is he's pitching in the Venezuela League right now. He's pitched 18 innings, hasn't given up a run yet. So he's a guy that people forget. He's a young kid. He's been through some ups and downs, but he's still a young prospect. They've got some numbers there and some depth, but they lost Chris Young, who's a free agent, and Jack would definitely like to bring in another veteran starter. I think, probably in that kind of vein, that, the Chris Young type, a guy who can come in and be a fourth, fifth starter for you and really be a veteran in that group and solidify the rotation, give you a little more depth. Maybe Chris Young is the guy. I don't know. I mean, he's a free agent that pitched well for them last year. But somebody like that that can kind of give you some more depth in that rotation and maybe a little more a proven presence down there in the back end of the rotation.
Greg, an under-the-radar move that the Mariners made this week was to sign a Cuban pitcher, and I don't know if I'm going to say his name right, Marcel Severo, to a minor league deal.
Correct.
And is the impact what did they like about him, and does he have any impact at all in getting Yasmani Tomas to come to Seattle? What do you think the big picture is there on this kid?
It's an interesting move because of all of what you just said there. I mean, Severio is a kid. He's 25-year-old Cuban. To me, I draw some parallels with Reyes Elias, who they brought in 25-year-old rookie last year that won 10 games for him. Kind of a similar path. Elias defected from Cuba a couple years ago, pitched in Mexico for 2 years, got into the Mariner minor league system, and was really a surprise last year. Severi, a little bit older, defected a year and a half ago or so, pitched in Cuba last year, and he's been waiting. He's one of a group of Cuban players that are out there this offseason. And the Cuban pipeline is pretty interesting. I mean, you look at the guys that are coming in right now, there's definitely some interest in them. Severi is not one of the big names out of that group. But as you mentioned, guys look at what other players do. Severi himself mentioned that one of the reasons he likes Seattle is because they did have some Cuban players and some of his countrymen in the organization, and he is acquaintances with Elias, same age, and is friends with him. So I don't believe he's a close friend with Yosmani Tomas, but I don't think it hurts when you're out there pushing for guys that you sign guys that they're familiar with. I'm pretty sure when Tomas eventually signed, it's probably going to be a team that stacks up a lot of dollar bills in front of him. But the Mariners are certainly one of those teams that are willing to stack. I mean, they're very interested in Yosmani Tomas. They're one of the teams that have tried him out and looked at him, and he would be the right-handed bat and a young prospect that could be pretty interesting. But how if you throw in you do what you can, and I don't know that that's why they signed Severio, because he's a pitcher in his own, as we mentioned, adding organizational depth. He's a guy that's probably going to pitch AAA next year and come in and be on that fringe. He's signed a minor league contract, but he's a 25-year-old with some background. So, does it all add up? Hey, who knows? But you do what you can, and if that adds up to opening one door for Yosmani Tomas, then, hey, all the better.
Yeah, and as we've learned, it's not a 25-man roster. It's a 40-man roster. Anyway, I appreciate it, Greg. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks. Thanks, as always. Great job.
You bet, Richard. Always good talking to you.
I'm joined by my old friend, Brian McTaggart, who covers the Astros for MLB.com. Brian, a couple of things. Jeff Luhnow said last week that he was probably going to bring fewer players to spring training, to camp. He thought that maybe they had too many players in camp and that it hurt some of their evaluations and maybe had impacted the poor starts they'd gotten off to. What do you make of this idea of bringing fewer players to camp? And do you think not getting a good evaluation of J.D. Drew might have had a role in this?
Yeah, I certainly think it could have. I mean, I think they were in the mid-60s. I mean, that's a lot of players to try to get on the field, get enough at bats. Now you have some guys coming in that are on the 40-man that have no chance of making the club, but still, you got to get guys at bats and innings, and it's really tough. And in the case of J.D. Martinez, I think he was a guy that had to prove himself, and they kind of, I think the Astros have kind of moved on a little bit with guys like Grossman, and they brought in Fowler, and they had Springer, so these bats weren't going to be there. The problem is that J.D. really put in a lot of work to revamp his swing, so he had something to prove. He went to winter ball, and he masked, and he came in, and he was ready to show them something, and never really got the opportunity in the spring anyway. He certainly had opportunities prior to that, but with his new swing, he never got the opportunity and ended up being the odd man out, and look at what he's done in Detroit.
And also, another thing Luhnow said last week is that with Jesse Crane not pitching last year and because of injuries and Matt Albers missing a portion of the season, that he would be more reluctant to sign guys with injury backgrounds. And that struck me as odd, in that a guy with an analytics background, that the numbers dictate everything you do, and that he would seem to have a different take on it. Do you think that as a GM that Jeff Luhnow is still evolving, still figuring things out along the way, even as he compiles all these young players for the farm system and tries to put a winning roster together?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, I think with each one of these years since he's been the owner, I mean, the GM, and they took some lumps, I think he's learned some things. And, you look at last year, they were coming off 111 losses. They didn't have a lot of money to spend. It was tough to get guys to come here. And, Matt Albers, is from Houston, so they were able to get him. And if he was healthy, he was an effective arm, but he wasn't. Justin Crane hadn't pitched half the year. Again, another Houston guy, so they were able to take a flyer on him. And, I think in a lot of these cases that, Scott Feldman, they gave a ton of money to, probably more than he would have got close to anywhere else, so they kind of overpaid for him. Chad Qualls had ties to Houston. So I think they either had to overpay for guys, take some chances on some injury guys, or get guys with local ties. In the case of Crane and Albers, it just didn't work out, and the help wasn't there. I mean, we thought that Crane might pitch at the beginning of last year. Then it was the end of May. Then it was the All-Star break, and then you start wondering if the guy will ever get back on the field. So I think it's all part of the learning process for him, and you know, I think they continue to evolve.
Yes, they finally had a local TV deal after a year and a half of getting zero money. They're going to get, I think it's $57 million in their new deal with Root Sports. And this will have a real impact on the running of the team. It will give Luno a chance to add to the team, improve the team, and sort of be more competitive. And it's so good from a marketing standpoint. Do you think the impact is every bit as great as marketing, getting people to come to the game, watch the game, to come to the game? Or is it the real area of, hey, we can afford more players now? Is it both those things, or is one more important than the other?
I mean, it's certainly going to have an impact on their payroll. Not as much as I'm sure they would have hoped 2 years ago when CSN Houston lost and they had big dreams and it all kind of fell. And they're not going to have the TV revenue coming in. They would have hoped a lot of other teams have. So they're going to have to be creative and really build through the draft and you use the Cardinals model. I know that's what Luno was trying to do. Instead of, I don't think we're going to see Astros go give anyone $325 million. But, the only way to I think, fill up the ballpark and get TV ratings going is just to win. I mean, that's the bottom line. I mean, we've been in this market long enough, and you can do all you want, have all the gimmicks you want. You got to win, and you can get people to come to the ballpark. And that's not unlike some places, but getting the games back on TV, I think it's going to be huge just from an identity standpoint, having people identify with the players, be able to watch the games, know who Jake Marisnik is, know who Springer is, more about him, Singleton, than just relying on what they read and what they hear from other people.
Brian, do you think in the Arizona Fall League, were there any developments for the Astros that maybe surprised them in a pleasant way, or maybe was there bad news from the Arizona Fall League? So far in the offseason, what's the news on how players are doing?
Well, I think Mark Appel was very, very good bright spot for them. He started out strong, had a couple of little rough outings, and then had some really good outings. And so Appel going up there and pitching, I think, 31 innings and having an ERA of 2.61, good strikeouts walk ratio, I think is a very promising sign. I mean, it was really a very unusual year for him, just with the beginning with the appendectomy and then not being able to pitch in Lancaster, going to extended spring training, and then going to Corpus and doing okay, and then finishing the season strong. I mean, that was a really positive sign for them. And Appel is hell-bent to pitch in the major leagues in 2015, and I don't think they've ruled it out. I don't think he's going to be in the opening day rotation by any stretch, but I think if Mark Appel reaches the major league at some point next year, I think they would be happy with that. Beyond that, Rio Ruiz, he played pretty well, didn't do anything, just completely eye-popping. They had a couple other guys there who were marginal prospects. Vincent Velasquez, he's one of their top right-handed prospects. Pitched okay, got hurt, had injury problems, but I think still he's one to watch. I mean, he's got one of the better arms in the system, and he could be in AAA by the time the season's open. And season's over, next season's over, and that's another arm going into 2016 that he's in the rotation, could be a middle of the rotation guy for them.
All right. A lot of news, a lot of things going on. Following winter meetings are a couple of weeks away. Brian, thanks for joining us today. Talk to you later.
Okay, thanks.
Joined by my old friend, T.R. Sullivan. T.R., how in the world are you?
We're doing well up here in Dallas-Fort Worth, Richard.
All right, well, you stay warm there because I know it's cold. So far, T.R., most of the offseason regarding the Rangers has been a lot of rumors, a lot of speculation. First, let me ask you about this. Do you think John Daniels is motivated to move Elvis Andrus, and would he?
Well, if you move Elvis Andrus, you got to find a shortstop because, they got Luis Sardinas, who's a young kid who I don't think they feel is ready to play every day in the major leagues. They have no idea how Jurickson Profar is going to come back from his shoulder. So to trade Elvis Andrus would just create another hole. If you could get a great starting pitcher, maybe you'd do it. But this is a guy with an 8-year, something like $120 million contract. So to trade him would be very, very difficult. So I'm not really thinking that they're going to trade Elvis Andrus this winter. I mean, they may surprise us and become creative, but I don't anticipate it.
Now, John Daniels mentioned last week that Elvis had lost 8 to 10 pounds, and he seems to have really committed himself to having a bounce-back season. I don't even know if a bounce-back season is necessary. You know the guy. Do you think he's been disappointed by his production the last couple of years, or you think this is just who he's going to be as a player?
I think it's going to be who he is as a player. Now, the numbers are going to go up and down every year. Some years are going to be better than the others. This was a bad year for the whole team. You know, Ron Washington kind of hinted at the fact that he thought, you know, Elvis was had lost a little bit of motivation because, you know, they had fallen out of the pennant race and, you know, it was hard staying focused. But, you know, Elvis Andrus is who he is. He's a good major league shortstop. You know, people think, you know, well, he's got a whole lot of upside offensively. You know, he's been good enough to play on a team that went to two World Series. You know, he's good enough. I don't know if he's going to get a whole lot better. You know, I don't know, dropping 8 to 10 pounds or gaining 8 to 10 pounds. You know, every year you go into spring training, some guys have gained weight to get stronger. Other guys have gained or lost weight to get quicker. You know, Elvis is who he is, and so far that's been good enough.
Yeah, it certainly has been good enough. What are the things John Daniels mentioned at the general manager's meeting? And I guess not watching the Rangers every day, I wouldn't be aware of this. But he said beyond the injuries, there were things that were exposed, not just some organizational thinness at the top, but that the base running got sloppy and some of the general baseball got sloppy. Do you think there was a problem with preparation, or was it just how losing manifested itself and players got impacted by losing?
I think it was manifested by losing, by the injuries, and just the whole season. You know, I go back to spring training. I remember watching those workouts in spring training, and they were some of the best run spring trainings I've ever seen. I mean, the Rangers really got after it. I mean, when I watched that team in spring training, I thought they were ready to go. I mean, to say that the preparation was different or was sloppy, you know, everybody, anytime a Rangers guy gets thrown out on the bases, everybody says, well, their base running is getting sloppy. And people forget it was incredibly aggressive base running that got into two World Series. I mean, I remember in one playoff game against the Tampa Bay Rays, they had three runners score from second base on balls that did not get out of the infield. I mean, one of them was Vladimir Guerrero. I mean, they were an incredibly aggressive base running, and everybody was just lauding them, oh, wow, this is an aggressive team. They play the game right, blah, blah, blah. But you start getting people thrown out on the base pass, and all of a sudden they're sloppy and they've lost focus and this and that. I mean, that's who they play. That's the way they played under Ron Washington, and it worked for 4 years and 90 wins a season, plus two World Series trips.
Well, when we talk about the Rangers needing help in the rotation beyond Holland and Darvish and whatever happens with Matt Harrison and Colby Lewis, do you think John has the depth in the organization to be able to trade for a veteran starter and then maybe – and then maybe get one of the secondary starters? Because unless it's all secret, they haven't been associated with any of the top guys. How do you think John's going to go about these two top spots?
Well, he definitely has the depth in the farm system. I mean, they got a ton of talent down there that they could trade in a minute if they wanted to. I don't think they wanted to. I think the big balance for John Daniels is to be able to make a trade for a starting pitcher and be able to hold on to a guy like Joey Gallo, you know, their top offensive prospect, or Luke Jackson or Alex Gonzalez, their two top pitching prospects, or Jorge Alfaro, their great catching prospect. I mean, those are the guys that teams want. When John Daniels calls and say, hey, is this pitcher available, they're going to ask if Joey Gallo's available. And, you know, that's not something the Rangers want to do. So it's going to come down to how John Daniels balances the assets that he has in the minor league system, which are considerable, and the type of talent that he wants to get in return.
Yeah, and Tiro, so let me ask you about a guy like Alex Gonzalez, Chi-Chi. He has pitched a little bit at Double-A, right? But he's never pitched at Triple-A.
He made 15 starts at Double-A last year.
Right. Okay. Could you project him a jump? And John mentioned this, but he just said, you know, the way player development people sell people, this is the guy they're selling, Alex Gonzalez. Could you see him pitching in the big leagues next year?
Next year, yes. Opening day, hopefully not. I still think he needs another 15 starts in the minor leagues, and I think the Rangers will give it to him. I think, you know, you still got Nick Tepish and you still got Nick Martinez. You know, both of them made strides last year. I still think Nick Tepish has a chance to be a pretty good pitcher in the big leagues. I mean, I'm looking at a guy like Jeremy Guthrie and what he did for the Royals last year, and I can see Nick Tepish filling that kind of role for the Rangers. So you still got some guys up here to look at before you start dipping into your minor league depth.
You know, and TR, it's interesting the way you say that, in that you bust your butt as a baseball general manager, as an organization, to have the kind of depth the Rangers have. And it's always a balancing act. When do we trade them? I remember when Dave Dombrowski traded Rob Brantley to Miami to get Anibal Sanchez. You think, that guy keeps me up awake at night. And I wonder how John balances the fact that you've got an organization that has a chance to stay in contention for a decade with all these kids, and yet there's some pressure to win now. How do you think he weighs that in his mind?
I think he struggles with it. I think all general managers have to struggle with it. I mean, if you look at the Rangers over the past 5 years, they've traded a lot of good young talent to other clubs to put themselves in position to contend. You know, they got that kid, Kyle Hendricks, pitching for the Cubs, was great. You know, the Rangers traded him. I think it was in the Ryan Dempster deal, if I remember correctly. You know, they traded Mike Olt, and you know, the Cubs had two guys, Neil Ramirez and Justin Grimm, in their bullpen, who were given up in the Matt Garza deal, plus another kid, C.J. Edwards, who pitched great in the Arizona Fall League. I mean, those are three good pitching prospects. So, you know, I think Daniels would love to have those guys back. He doesn't. He was trying to win. And, you know, it's a balancing act for every general manager. And I think right now, if you look at it, Richard, I think Daniels is going to be a little more conservative with the younger players right now, at least for a year or so, and let them grow and see who's got real talent, who's got a real chance to be an impact player. So I don't think you're going to see him at this point, with the Rangers coming off a 95-loss season. I don't think you're going to see John Daniels rush in to make some big trades with a lot of his young talent until he sees that this team is close to contending.
It's funny, Sandy Alderson of the Mets said exactly the same thing. Sometimes you have to let the young players mature before you figure out what you have, and it might be a guy you would consider untouchable. John Daniels, since the last time we talked, John Daniels has gotten a contract extension, and I guess when you look at the whole body of his work, pretty darn impressive, huh?
I mean, they went to two World Series. They had four 90-win seasons. I mean, last year was a bad year, and maybe this, you know, some people think it was an aberration. You know, it may be a trend. Maybe this organization is going to go through some tough times. But sure, when you go to two World Series and you have the kind of years that they had, I mean, somebody's got to be doing something right around here.
And that's and you're part of that. You're part of the solution. You're not part of the problem. But I appreciate your time, TR, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks, buddy.
Okay, guys.
Visit the official online shop of Major League Baseball at MLB.com/shop for the largest selection of authentic caps, T-shirts, jerseys, hoodies, collectibles, and more. Get your gear straight from the source, the MLB.com shop.